Before we get to the serious stuff, guys, I have to say, watching the State of the Union last night and the epic struggle of Mike Johnson, unlikely speaker, to not lose his stuff entirely. Do you think he's going to become as famous as the fly on Mike Pence's head? Sometimes it's the visuals, right?
Yeah, he looked like a man trying out for a community theater production of Harry Potter, demonstrating all conceivable facial expressions while wearing a child's glasses.
They remind me of there's a children's book called Encyclopedia Brown.
Where that's a good one.
Big glasses like that.
Deep cut. Anyway, deep cut there, Jane. That's right. I totally agree.
By the way, the tweet that won the evening for me, Jane, last night was the guy who watched his failed struggle to keep a straight face and said, I really want to play poker with that guy.
Did Biden basically diss him by not giving him the chance to say what they usually do say? The speaker usually says, I have, you know, the supreme or whatever it is, high honor and privilege of introducing the president of the United States.
Good there catch.
That disappeared, right?
Yes. And the question is, was that on purpose or was Biden just eager to get into it since he'd been clearly revved up to go and punch, 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 which I guess is a transition to our substantive conversation.
I think so.
Welcome to The Political Scene, a weekly discussion about the big questions in American politics. I'm Susan Glasser, and I'm joined by my colleagues Evan Osnos and Jane Mayer. Hey, Jane.
Hi, Susan.
Hello, Evan.
Hi there, guys.
My lifetime has taught me to embrace freedom and democracy, a future based on core values that have defined America: honesty, decency, dignity, equality, to respect everyone, to give everyone a fair shot, to give hate no safe harbor.
Exhale. My guess is that's the sound that a lot of Democrats are making after last night's very, shall we say, vigorous performance by President Biden. The annual State of the Union address has become an entire event in and of itself in Washington. The political scene was absolutely dominated by the run-up to the big speech, though I'm not sure anyone actually expected what really happened. A very different Joe Biden coming out swinging after a not-so-super Tuesday, when Donald Trump managed earlier than ever to lock up the Republican nomination for president for the third consecutive national election. Whatever the buildup, the speech in the end was one of the biggest platforms that President Biden will have all year to make his case directly to the American people. So, did he deliver? And what does that even mean in the year 2024? Does the State of the Union actually have the attention of voters? Can anything change their minds? Evan, I gotta ask, what makes President Biden so revved up on a night like this?
What gets him so revved up, honestly, is a bunch of people saying this guy's dead in the water. I mean, it is truly like his Gatorade. Honestly, like I watched the moment that he left the White House on his way to the car, he had this little sort of skip. And I think, look, his natural home, the place where he feels most comfortable, and I know it is a kind of complete political cliche, but he is most comfortable when people are telling this guy, you're not going to be able to do it. He almost kind of needs that to coil the spring. And look, a speech like that, I don't think it's an overstatement. And I know that there's a lot of hyperbole when we talk about politics sometimes. But in 51 years in politics, I think you'd be hard-pressed to come up with a speech that Joe Biden has given where there was more on the line for him personally, for the country, for his party. It could have gone wrong in 100 different ways. You had weird hecklers. You had somebody ejected from the chamber. You had them giving him a button on the way in for a young woman who was killed by an undocumented immigrant. I mean, the complexities were vast. And, I think I'll be curious what you guys think. But halfway through, I was starting to get text messages from Democrats, various places around the country, independents, whatever. And they were all having the same reaction, which is like, this guy seems to be doing better than the portrayal of him so far would suggest. And I think by the end, that was the consensus view. But what did you guys make of it?
Well, Jane, a million things can go wrong. What went right for Joe Biden? Do you agree with Evan?
I mean, I do. I mean, it was a surprisingly vigorous performance in a much more political and partisan speech than you usually get for a State of the Union. Usually State of the Unions, I hate to say it, I mean, they are soporific events. And the biggest challenge is for reporters to stay awake from one end to the other often. That this was not that kind of speech. This was actually an exciting speech. It was quite amazing. But at the same time, I have to say, the bar was low. I mean, by the expectations had been driven so low that basically if he could put one foot in front of the other and get through that speech without, you know, falling off the podium, people would have said, oh, he's not as old as we thought he was. So, I mean, in some ways, all of this negative press coverage did him a favor because all he had to do, in, to some extent, was get through the speech with a certain amount of energy, and he did do that. I mean, there were some, I mean, if we're critiquing just his presentation, I mean, I still, you know, think that there were some garbles, there were some marbles in his mouth. I mean, he is, you know, he's not the best deliverer of speeches, but it was a humdinger. I mean, he really came out swinging, and I think it took people by surprise right from the start.
Well, Jane, it's an important point you made about defining expectations down. I saw that Sean Hannity over on Fox News, who's done more than just about anyone except for Donald Trump to promote the Sleepy Joe mantra, he was spitting mad after the show. I think he was completely confounded. He called him Jacked Up Joe.
And that's being charitable. He sounded like a hyper-caffeinated, angry old man. We'll have a lot more on that coming up.
He certainly, in my observation, was loud. He seemed to substitute volume or to see volume as a stand-in for vigor. And age was obviously top of mind for both the president and his speechwriters.
I've been told I was too young. By the way, they didn't let me on the Senate elevators for votes sometimes. Not a joke. And I've been told I'm too old. Whether young or old, I've always known what endures. I've known our North Star.
Evan, do you think he addressed that correctly?
I thought that was one of the most important pieces of this, because there has been this lurking question of whether he would sort of take on age in a full-throated way. I mean, I probed a bit to figure out if they were going to do a big speech on it. You know, was he going to give a kind of JFK on Catholicism speech? The answer was no. But what they've done, and this was new language, really, was him more or less saying, and this is something we're going to hear a lot of, which is, I am a reminder of a time when America believed in things in politics, and this is romantic because this is, he's running for office here, but, you know, things like decency, integrity, that, I mean, that is actually a pretty clever way of taking on this issue and making it his own. That was probably an effective tool. Look, let's be honest. The age thing is going to be a story every day until the end of this election, but last night was a very clear rebuttal to what has been this little air bubble of speculation about, you know, could he be replaced? Could we have an open convention? All that stuff, I think that was just punctured pretty loudly last night.
Yeah, Jane, there was a lot of almost fantastical theorizing among the kind of Democratic adjacent commentary class, you know, dreaming of a moment where President Biden would give a long speech, you know, full-throated attack on Donald Trump, and then at the end say, and so now, for the good of the country, I'm going to step aside. That obviously did not happen. In fact, he was much more confrontational, I thought, than usual. Very direct from the beginning. He came out swinging. There's some easy, obvious enemies, not only Donald Trump, but Vladimir Putin, those meddling judges who were taking away women's reproductive freedom. What did you think of Joe Biden pugilist last night?
I thought it was very effective. I mean, and I actually think, and you mentioned the judges. It's quite unusual to see a president basically criticize the Supreme Court to its face as they're standing there in the State of the Union. I mean, and you had the Chief Justice, John Roberts, and you had Neil Gorsuch, two of the people who voted to overturn Roe v. Wade, and you had a president saying to them to their face,
those bragging about overturning Roe v. Wade have no clue about the power of women, but they found out when reproductive freedom was on the ballot, we won in 2022 and 2020, and we'll win again in 2024.
And I am going to restore it if you give me the Congress that can pass the legislation. You know, that sort of crossed a line that usually is not crossed. And I think it shows you, you know, just how he was trying to energize and mobilize women and voters to come out and get behind him. It was a very aggressive move. Anyway, he was really swinging. I think it worked pretty well.
Well, Jane, I agree with you that that is the one that leapt out to me, to have the Supreme Court justices in the room. And there was just even the visual contrast of the sort of judges in their black robes surrounded by a sea of Democratic women in white, recalling the suffragist past, recalling the fight for reproductive freedom. I just thought that that was almost the visual of the evening for me, even more so than that crazy confrontation between Joe Biden and Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's wearing the MAGA hat on the floor of the House, despite the chamber's rules that suggest you shouldn't be wearing campaign paraphernalia on the floor. It was really, I think, a striking visual representation of our divisions. To Evan's point, it's a kind of a chicken or the egg existential debate at this point. You know, who is the provocateur creating the division versus those reacting to it? I will say that having watched a lot of these speeches, Peter Baker informed me last night he's covered 23 states of the Union. But having watched a lot of them, it was, in a way, the most partisan of these speeches I've ever seen. I thought, looking at these Republicans, at times they were squirming in their seats as if they had sort of accidentally been forced to sit through the Democratic National Convention. but I think we should turn for a second to the substance of the speech. It was primarily political, obviously, but, you know, it was very interesting to me, embedded within it, what were the messages that we heard. Jane, reproductive freedom was one. Were there others that stood out to you?
Well, I mean, I think he very cleverly took on foreign policy in a way that made it seem he cast the Trump position, the person he referred to 13 times only as his predecessor, as the weak position. And he basically identified himself with Ronald Reagan, saying,
"It wasn't long ago when a Republican president named Ronald Reagan thundered, 'Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.'" Now, my predecessor, a former Republican president, tells Putin, quote, "Do whatever the hell you want." That's a quote.
And he then went on to sort of suggest that, "I will not bow down to these enemies of democracy," and which made Trump appear to be the weakling who's giving in. And Trump's trying to cast himself as a strong man. So basically, Biden took back the mantle of, "I am the strong one. I will not bow down, and we will not bow down." And I thought that was a very clever maneuver.
What about on the economy, Evan? There was a lot of almost triumphalist language that the president used, saying, you know, basically, we've overcome the doubters and we now have the strongest economy. What did you make of that and this theme of economic populism, really, that Biden has tried to present as core to his campaign message?
You know, it's a balance between trying to meet people where they are in terms of still feeling like prices are too high, and then also talking about these generational challenges like the assault on democracy here and abroad. And there was there was this very clear choice in the structure of the speech where he started very clearly on democracy. It was a kind of unusual way to start with foreign policy and with this big and bold opening. And, you know, I have to tell you, having spent a lot of time poking around in his life, when he says, "I will not bow down," that is a direct echo of his mother telling him when, as an Irishman going to meet the Queen of England for the first time, she said, "Don't you bow to her." So there is, and it's core to Joe Biden's sort of self-narrative about not being cowed by authority. And that is something that is part of what makes him so viscerally contemptuous of Trump, is that he sees this person as this sort of sniveling toady to Vladimir Putin, which he finds just kind of a defiling of the presidency. There's just no other way to put it. On the economy, there are going to be people who are not feeling like, as he put it, you know, the greatest comeback never told has already unfolded. I think there is a lot of pain out there. But this is about him injecting more evidence into the bloodstream of the ways in which the economy is today, by any objective measure, cruising along. And he wants to tell people that.
Jane, on that contrast with Donald Trump, you know, key number stood out to me, 13 times. That's the number of times that Biden in the speech referred directly to, quote, my predecessor. He didn't actually call Trump by name, but even calling out of one's opponent is an unusual move. Did it work? What is the contrast that Biden was setting up for people there?
Well, sure. What it did was it took a State of the Union address and turned it into a campaign rally. I mean, and the reason he could do that is because you rarely have two presidents running against each other. But because the former president is now running again against Biden, he could talk about my predecessor as if it's just a State of the Union issue having to do with the policy changes in the government. Instead, what it is a clash of visions that he could just, you know, go right at. And so, I mean, it made it a much more exciting speech this way.
Well, let's talk about that. Exciting. I know in my role as a call it a reality checker here, or, you know, maybe the back to earth person. The question, of course, in all of this is, does it matter? Right. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more, not only about the speech, but what effect it might have on the actual campaign.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
All right. So, guys, when President Biden came into that chamber last night, he had the highest average disapproval ratings of his entire presidency, over 56% of Americans. Think back to last year's State of the Union. Democrats were coming off an impressive showing in the midterms. Inflation was going down. And most importantly, Biden's performance during that speech a year ago inspired a lot of confidence, actually, about his fitness to run. He did a good job last year in a different way than he did this year. And yet at the end of the day, according to the polls, the numbers were essentially unchanged. It certainly didn't benefit Biden politically at all. If anything, his status is more shaky a year later than it was back then. So, Evan, what do you make of whether this speech or any speech matters anymore? Is the presidential bully pulpit just gone?
No, I think they do matter. I think in the same way that this speech had tremendous downside risk for him, it has upside potential. I mean, just even in the very small incremental measurements of last night, there were these little flash polls that were done by the networks. And one of the things that you saw was just even afterwards, people who watched the speech were more likely, in some cases by 5 or 10%, to say, oh, OK, his handling of the economy is good, better than it was before the speech, or they think that he's fit for the presidency. So somebody said last night that a speech like this, very few people beyond the nerd caucus is going to watch the speech from beginning to end. But what they do get is a kind of reverberation effect. These little, the vibes, as they're known, that just kind of, what do you hear at the office if somebody says the speech was good? Anyway, all of that stuff adds up. And what we're not saying here, and I think it's important to say it out loud, is the press is a part of this because there's a feedback loop. And when the press is constantly saying Joe Biden is unpopular, Joe Biden is too old, that is, in a sense, kind of seeding the conversation. Like I said at the outset, this is not the end of the conversation about all of his liabilities. But it is also a fact that when you have a performance of the kind that you saw last night, it begins to add some additional information into that bloodstream.
Jane, do you think there will be any material difference in the polls a week or a month from now as a result of this speech?
I mean, I you know, I'm not good at predicting the future, but I do want to sort of respond to something Evan said, which you were saying, that what makes the bully pulpit is not just the pulpit, but the press. The president, it's an interactive thing, and it goes all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt, who used the phrase bully pulpit, and who was very friendly with the press corps around him, as was FDR's press corps, as was JFK's press corps. To be a successful president, you really need to have a great relationship with the press. They are the amplifiers. And really, in recent times, Biden has not had a good relationship with the press. He hasn't given very many interviews. He's given very few press conferences. And so part of this bully pulpit effect has to be not just the speech, but also whether it will carry through to a good relationship with the press, whether it will give him more sort of confidence about dealing with the press and being open, and then with the press then sort of echo that, oh, he's not dead. He's not just walking dead. He's actually fighting. And, you know, so I think, you know, that is the very important part of this equation.
Another theme, though, that we've talked an awful lot about on this show is the increasingly almost calcified partisan divide in the country. And for that reason, it's actually harder to move public opinion on a broad variety of fronts. It used to be that there were major swings in how the public looked at an American president based on his performance in office. You had George H.W. Bush, who was up in the 90s because of the success of the first Gulf War, and then a year later losing re-election. It's inconceivable that you could see major shifts like that in our politics anymore when people play politics as team sports.
No, that's absolutely true. I just want to say, Susan, you're absolutely right that he could give the best speech. He could give, you know, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, and half this country would either not hear it or would hear from talking heads who said that was the worst speech they ever heard. I mean, so it's such a divided media sphere at this point that you kind of have to assume that you can't move the needle in half the country.
But I think what that also does, though, is it means it focuses attention on the people who are persuadable. I mean, the reality is this is partly generational. Above a certain age, all of us are basically baked in. But there is a group of people that are in play. And part of a speech like this is, you know, do they pick up on the little bits of information that tell them, you know, we had a young guy at dinner the other night and he said, I don't even think that Joe Biden's running the government. I think it's being run by his advisors. And it was just fascinating to me that he'd gotten that in the groundwater somehow. And it's those kinds of people that are reachable and in play.
Well, that goes to another important question. Evan, to me, what I heard was a speech that was actually aimed at wavering Democrats and people who voted for Joe Biden before. I didn't hear any effort to persuade Republicans. I think he knew, as you said, that they were going to sit on their hands and, not do him any favors. He wasn't looking to convince anybody. What he was looking to do was to tell his own side, stop freaking out. I'm in the fight. I'm in the race. And I think that's a very different metric. But I just want to finish the conversation about media, though. Obviously, the folks in the White House and the campaign are well aware of the fragmented media space in which we live, Evan. What is their theory of the case about how to navigate this kind of media environment? As Jane put it, they're not exactly interested in giving interviews, except, of course, to the New Yorker magazine.
I know. It's all kind of fragmented. I don't think I have a good sense of their strategy. You know, they chose Fareed Zakaria, for instance, from CNN, or they did 60 Minutes, or they did, you know, Telemundo, and they didn't do the Super Bowl. And, you know, they're sensitive about the suggestion that they don't do as many interviews. I think it's on some level, I think this gets to your question, Jane, about is it Biden himself who is not making him available, or is it the people around him who are nervous that if he does it, that he's going to say something that sets him back? And, you know, I think that if last night can have an effect on the White House, what it should do is tell them, do more. Like, get him out there. Have him talking to more of the media outlets that don't right now get enough access to him. I don't think it's going to put him at risk. I think it's actually going to fortify him.
I'm curious, Evan, I just have to ask, because there are people who are saying, after seeing that speech last night, where has this Joe Biden been? And I'm wondering, did you see this Joe Biden when you interviewed him?
I did, actually. I mean, when I described him on the page.
But he probably wasn't quite so loud.
You know, actually, when he gets pumped up, I mean, he gets... I think that that is exactly, honestly, the person that I saw. What I mean by that specifically is, when he gets revved up on these issues, he's a little more profane in a one-on-one environment than he is in the hallowed well of the Congress. And, you know, he yesterday had the off-the-record lunch that he always has with the anchors from TV before the speech. And if you talk to them, a lot of them came away with the same impression that you then saw in the State of the Union, which is like, oh, okay, actually, when you get this guy talking, it's not exactly the Fox News segment you've been seeing for months.
All right. Well, that's another good moment to take a break, I think, in this conversation. There's just so much to unpack. But when we come back, this week is basically the beginning of one of the longest general election campaigns we've ever had, right? You know, Joe Biden is out there. He's throwing punches. Donald Trump, as of the aftermath of Super Tuesday this week, is the lone Republican left standing. Nikki Haley dropped out. When we come back, we'll talk about what it means for the general election and how both of these candidates are getting out their message in 2024.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, so guys, the Republicans, Donald Trump, you know, it's such a weird environment. We have Joe Biden giving this big, full-throated speech. Donald Trump, meanwhile, was sending out on social media a clip of Joe Biden with grotesque Instagram filters on his face. It literally was if a sort of snarky sixth grader was responding to the presidential speech. Meanwhile, you had the official Republican response from Alabama Senator Katie Britt. People were responding to that. I'm sure there will be a Saturday Night Live skit that captures this pretty well. But basically,
yes,
there's a big debate about whether that was even worse than the famous Marco Rubio glass of water Republican response. Where do Republicans come back into the picture on this? You know, it's as if both teams right now in 2024 are playing in parallel, non-intersecting games.
Yeah, it was very noticeable, just because even if you looked at the commentary right after the speech, you know, what it was that Republicans were saying was, you know, why is he angry? Why is he shouting? Why is this political? And Democrats were saying, wow, look at this guy. This is something that we hadn't seen. And you kind of have to go out of your way to dip into the alternative universe if you're in one or the other. And that is just a profound change in this country. And I think from a purely bluntly electoral perspective, I don't think it matters that much. There weren't that many MAGA Republicans that were going to be persuaded by a State of the Union speech. So what he's fighting for is to mobilize Democrats, get them to reunify in the way that they did in 2020. That's the ballgame.
Yeah. Speaking of MAGA Republicans, Jane, it seems like all Republicans more or less are falling in line. We talked a little bit last week about Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, deciding not to run again. And we were wondering, well, what does that mean for him in politics? But he went ahead and he did it this week, and he endorsed Donald Trump, a man he hasn't spoken to since the aftermath of the 2020 election, a man he accused of, directly blamed for the events of January 6th. And yet there was Mitch McConnell and so many other Republicans, Marco Rubio, I'm thinking of you, falling right back in line, along with the MAGA hard right. What do you make of that new element in this year's race?
I know. And even Trump even coined racist, nasty nicknames for McConnell's wife. And nonetheless, he talked about bowing down. He bowed down. To Trump.
They all did, right? In the end, that's the story, right?
Sure, that is the story. That's what we're looking at. This was an extraordinary week to have both Super Tuesday and the State of the Union in the same week. And basically what we're seeing is the complete, you know, clarification of the campaign. It's got all of the Republicans are now behind Trump. Nikki Haley is out, and Trump is obviously the almost inevitable nominee. Unless something happens, something crazy happens. And then we've got Biden basically essentially waking up and taking on the fight. It's like game on time. And that's what we're looking at.
Can I ask a question? This is Susan. Can I just ask Jane, you've spent so much time thinking about Mitch McConnell. Can you explain in the end?
Yes. Mitch McConnell. This is the thing. Mitch McConnell, I would say he never fails to disappoint in the end. I mean, he has missed every chance to step up to the challenge to do the hard right thing. He just doesn't. He's a deeply political survivalist. And survival in the Republican Party right now means going along with Trump. And that's what he's going to do. He will not go in the opposite direction from where the crowd is because he just wants to win.
Wow.
More than anything. Yeah. He wants to win and basically, you know, face it. Right now, Trump is the winner in the party.
Well, right. That's he it. Looks like a loser, not a winner. That's the amazing thing. It looks like his brand of Republicanism has lost out.
It's lost. Can I just say one other thing, though, that I think is kind of interesting, having just, you know, sampled a little bit right after the State of the Union, taking a look at what the far right of the Republican Party is saying. It was kind of interesting. Usually they are in lockstep as they are behind Trump, but their messaging last night was not in lockstep. They were thrown back on their heels and didn't really know how to respond to this new Biden. So they criticized him for being partisan. They criticized him for being loud. Basically, they didn't know what to do with this. This is because it's a completely different narrative than Sleepy Joe, and they were kind of falling all over themselves. So, I think you score one for Biden.
You know, but, Evan, in your piece, you had an interesting observation from Sarah Longwell, the former Republican, about the need for more robust surrogates and more people to amplify the message and to get it out, in part perhaps because there are some Republicans that Biden and his campaign still want to speak to. They may not be a majority. They may not even be as big of a minority in the Republican Party as we once saw or imagined them to be. How does the campaign speak to that crucial segment of voters? In my view, this is the group of people that actually could decide the outcome of the election. In some ways, you could say it was disaffected Republicans who elected Joe Biden to the presidency in 2020 and could do it again.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was talking to Sarah Longwell this morning, in fact, on this very topic, because this is precisely the moment now when, okay, you've got a tailwind out of an important speech like that. Now, how do you magnify it and fortify it? And that takes some discipline on the part of Democrats who want Joe Biden to succeed. You know, you've got to have people who get out there, as she says, with a knife in their teeth, prosecuting a case against Republicans. What it means is deciding that that this is now the time to take this to Donald Trump.
I hate to say it, but I think you can pretty much count on them not moving forward with message discipline. Because the Democrats do not have the same kind of media discipline that the Republicans do. And they, it's a matter of moments before, you know, they start fighting with each other again. It's just, you know, we've all seen it happen.
Her view, I mean, it's kind of interesting. It's a sort of media analysis story. But Sarah's view is the reason why, and she came up in Republican politics, the reason why it has this more cohesive, disciplined culture is because it was on the outside. It was kind of, they were essentially organs that were rejected from the mainstream media system. So they set up their own right-wing media enterprises, and they kind of looked out for each other. And so on, they would amplify each other on social media because it was kind of, they felt like they were in this information asymmetry, whereas Democrats, who felt like they had the commanding heights of the culture, never felt the need to be quite so focused and energetic. And so they would fight amongst themselves.
That makes sense. But I think I would take it one step further, which was what the conservative movement did was set up an alternative media system that was not actually journalism. They set up an alternative propaganda machine. So they're really not doing the same things. You know, the Daily Caller is not the equivalent of the New York Times. It's a very different beast.
Call it the ghost of Roger Ailes hanging over all of us. Although I take issue with one word, and that is the word discipline as applied to Donald Trump. You know, when he starts talking, as he inevitably will, about conspiracy theories of how and why Joe Biden gave such a energetic performance last night, or, you know, windmills, literally windmills is one of his pet causes. I'm curious, have you guys been able to stomach listening directly to Donald Trump lately? Where do you think he's at in that campaign? Did you watch his very, very early in the evening victory speech the other night when he was sort of dunking on Nikki Haley? His campaign may be more disciplined this year, but Donald Trump, it seems to me, is saying not only not welcome to Nikki Haley's voters, but you're scum of the earth. You know, be gone with you. That's not exactly what most consultants would have him do right now when he needs their votes.
This is true. But the thing that's amazing is, given who Donald Trump is at this point, someone with, you know, how many indictments?
Four indictments. But there's also
counts.
The civil cases.
Okay. Given who he is, what's incredible is that the party poobahs are behind him. I mean, they do not say, they're not having the yips and saying, oh, is he too old? Is he too indicted? They're completely behind him. And that's where the discipline is. But you're absolutely right that he himself, I mean, he's all over the map. He does, I have to say, I have watched him a bit, and he does have energy. He makes, you know, sense about less than 50% of the time and says some of the most ridiculous things and objectionable things you could say. But he's got a kind of a commanding presence. And I think that it's a mistake of Democrats to write that off. You really have to pay attention to it.
Evan, maybe put your, I know you've been in Bidenology mode, but maybe put your Trumpologist hat on for just a second here as we close out. What does Donald Trump do with a speech like Joe Biden's State of the Union?
I don't think he really has the equipment to deal with it. He is, in a sense, undone by the demonstration of clear, principled positions on things like Putin's attack on Ukraine. I mean, there is no answer that Donald Trump can give to that because he doesn't have an answer. He is so bereft of any defensible moral or strategic position on that subject that all he can do is essentially rage about retribution and all the rest. And I just think that actually, after all of our discussion of the performance and the aesthetics of last night, which I think are really important, these are not minor issues, the substance is really the enduring reality of the difference between these two campaigns. And in the final moments when people are choosing between these two guys, they're choosing between such radically different conceptions of what this country is and what it stands for. And I think in the end, Donald Trump doesn't have a whole lot to stand on with that.
He's going to fearmonger about the border. And maybe more important than his immediate reaction to the State of the Union was the ad he put up, I think it was just yesterday, that is about the young woman who was murdered by an undocumented immigrant. They came up, obviously, in the State of the Union last night. But this is, I mean, this is the Willie Horton ad of 2024.
If there is an unpleasant reality in politics these days, what you do is you ignore it and prefer the reality that you construct. We have Joe Biden's America, Donald Trump's America on display, I think, this week. And these two things are very, very different places. We didn't even talk about the return of George Santos to the House floor, but that's
thank God
a subject for another week. Guys, thank goodness we have each other to puzzle through this extraordinary moment in our politics.
So good to be with you.
Always a pleasure, guys. Thank you.
This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. I'm Susan Glasser. We had production assistance today from Alex D'Elia, Dan Richards, and Stephanie Kariuki. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Condé Nast Global Head of Audio is Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. We'll be back next week. Thank you so much for listening.